Have you ever heard of the Night Hag? There's this legend that exists just about, well, in just about every culture around the world, of this strange witch-like creature that crawls up onto your chest as you're sleeping, breathing her hot breath into your face. And the crazy thing about this legend is that there's variations of it that happen all over the world. And like a lot of things that happen everywhere around the world, there is actually a fascinating biological reason for why this creature haunts the global nightmares. Well, what's this have to do with the conversation and this like epically long video that you're about to get into? So recently, I put out this book called Dream, The Art and Science of Slumber, which is all about the strange world of dreams and dreaming and what dreams and consciousness have to do with each other. And I had this opportunity to speak with one of my favorite people in the world recently. Her name's Kate Kavanaugh, and she's this host of the Mind, Body, Soil podcast. And she is, well, she's not the Night Hag, but she is this really interesting woman who... well, how do you say it? She's a professional butcher. She owns a farm in Vermont, has a butcher shop here in Colorado, and is just fascinated by just about everything. And this conversation first appeared on Kate's podcast, which you should totally check out. And there are links down there in the description. I'm going to just play you a video from her Instagram feed so you can get an idea of what this woman is about. Yeah, that's her breathing into the lungs of a cow that she just recently slaughtered to demonstrate the lung capacity of a cow. This lady's amazing. And we had this great conversation, and I'm just going to dump you right into it, and you can see where we go. We're going to start with the Night Hag, and we're going to end up in somewhere just so totally awesome.
Because I've had the weirdest year of sleep of my life. Mm-hmm. I've had insomnia for the first time in my life. Mm-hmm. And I had a resurgence of, I have sleep paralysis.
Oh no.
Which is a fascinating, fascinating phenomenon.
Totally. I have ideas and thoughts about sleep paralysis. I've only had it like once or twice. But it's like terrifying. And it's like this weird thing where your body, you know, usually you're paralyzed when you go to sleep. That's why, you know, because mm-hmm. when you're dreaming, you're acting out, your brain thinks it's the real world. Like your mm-hmm. brain thinks a dream is the real world. So it's like sending the signals to move your muscles. And then we have this other evolutionary program to be like, you really shouldn't do that, people. Like, and it paralyzes your body, even though your brain is doing that. And then it also like squenches off cortisol. So you physically cannot be stressed out in a dream, which is weird.
That fascinated me. I didn't mm-hmm. know that until your book.
Yeah. I mean, there's other things that happen. There's other chemicals and things, but like you don't release cortisol. And then when you wake up, that paralysis program was not like removed, and then you're stuck, and it's super anxiety inducing, because you're usually not stuck in life. Like usually you don't have that paralysis nope. feeling, and then that makes you anxious. And then you yes. get this, like very. Sometimes. Yeah. And the common thing was like the hag that sits on your chest. Like this is the old timey thing. Like they call it the Night Hag in like the old timeys in like the 1700s. And it was the feeling of a person actually on you. Cause that's what your brain does. It's like, no, someone else is doing this to me.
And there's a paranoia that can come with it. Mm-hmm. Like a feeling that there is another entity in the room. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just crippling anxiety that you are, my fear is always that I now have locked in syndrome, right? That I'm stuck forever, within my own body, unable to move, but still conscious.
Well, you had it. You did have locked in syndrome. It was just short locked in syndrome. And mm-hmm. since you have it, you probably know how to get out of it better than I do. But like my understanding is that if you just tell yourself, oh, I'm having sleep paralysis right now, it will go away soon. That helps.
This is really funny because my sleep paralysis really only happens when I'm napping I am dozing after being awake in the middle of the night, which is usually how insomnia shows up for me. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of happens in those lighter spaces of sleep. Mm-hmm. And I often find that when I am in sleep paralysis, I am on what I would call the cusp of that hypnagogic space, mm-hmm. that I am awake, but not quite. There is a little bit of an element of thick, viscous, dreamy quality to everything. And I mm-hmm. find that getting out of that sort of experience of the groggiest you've ever felt is really hard. And one of the things, few things I can regulate is my breathing. And often if I can speed up my breathing, I can kind of begin to wake up my body. And then I have to force myself into a sitting, like up and sitting, or else I'll fall right back into that paralysis. Interesting.
So actually, we're probably going to get into this. We've already just like jumped into the podcast. We're like, all right, where are we going? So hypnagogia is the, and I pronounce that in like eight different ways. So I'll say it like three different ways.
Me too. I say hypnagogia.
Yeah, me too. So what that is that's your first, like that's when you're falling asleep, but you're not quite asleep, but you're sort of asleep and you're having these like sort of free associations. I don't think you're getting sleep paralysis there. I think you actually went down at least one more level into like stage two sleep and then woke up out of it. And you're like, you know, when you wake up from a nap and you feel like you're underwater, you're like, things just don't work right. What's going on? That is, you were sort of in between that and the next stage where you actually get paralyzed. Mm-hmm. And like, that's the worst nap. Like the worst nap ends at that point because you're like, how do you get out of it? Like, it's hard. Like,
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And I think, I mean, since we're here, I just want to dive right in because I think that one of the interesting things is to think about, and I always think about this whenever I'm in sleep paralysis, is like, who am I in this space? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting that your book played with was this idea of consciousness and this sort of idea that we think that who we are in sleep is different than who we are in our wakeful life, and playing with both that idea and the idea of consciousness as a continuum, not an on-off switch.
Right.
And I kind of wanted to start there because I thought that this was a really, I don't know, interesting place to play around in.
Yeah, it's the most interesting part of the book, of my journey. Like, it's why I didn't do a napping book. It's why I did a dream book, because all of my, not all of my books, but most of my books have to do with consciousness in some way.
They like, do. Yeah.
Who are we? What does awareness mean? How do I act in the world? What is my relationship with outside of my body? And dreams are sort of like what's going on inside the body. And the, we can talk about this in a few different ways, but when we are dreaming, like in the normal waking world, when you sense what's going on outside your body, you know, your flesh sack, you get all of that information through your nerves, through your peripheral nervous system. And in order for it to get into your brain, it has to literally travel. Like, it has to travel, and traveling takes time.
Oh, not, yes. Okay.
Yeah. Not very much time. But a little bit of time. In fact, like on average, it's like, depending on the length of the signal, it's about 1/5 of a second. That's how far the lag is. And from an evolutionary perspective, 1/5 of a second doesn't matter all the time, but it does sometimes. Like if someone was shooting an arrow at you or throwing a spear at you, you don't want to be 1/5 of a second behind in your reactions. You want to be like on the spot, but you literally cannot detect. Your brain can't detect and react in that time. So what your brain does, and this is insane, is it gets that information and it assembles the information from that world into experience, we can call it. This is the experience of consciousness, which is a simulation of the world, because your brain isn't directly experiencing the world. It's experiencing the electrical and chemical signals, and it's telling you what those signals mean. And so there's that, like, already what you experience in the world is a simulation, and it's behind time. So then what your brain does, and this is all very well established neuroscience, like I'm not making shit up. This is the way it goes. What your brain does is then it makes a whole predictive model about the world and speeds it up 1/5 of a second. So you're not only not experiencing the world, you're experiencing the world behind time, and then you're experiencing the simulation of the world in advance. And that is how you and me are talking. That is how you do everything. It's like this weird simulation plus prediction. And sometimes it's wrong. Like sometimes it's wrong, which leads me to this like stunning, stunning revelation, which is that throughout the day, when you're awake, you are actually dreaming. The simulation we live in is a dream because it's a projection. It's a simulation. So when you're dreaming when you're actually asleep and doing what we normally think of as dreaming, that is a more fidelitous simulation of consciousness than anything else. So I'm flipping everything on its head because it all happens in your dream. It doesn't need to speed it up, doesn't need to make predictions. It just comes from what's already there. This can lead me to like an existential crisis if you want to go down the hole. Now, I'm not saying like the world's a simulation like Elon Musk might make it, but it is a neurological simulation that we all live in.
Have you read Andy Clark's The Experience Machine?
No, it sounds great. Radar? Great title.
I pulled this out because you have this sort of tension that you put in the book between perception and conception, mm-hmm. right? That we have these external stimuli, which you've written about a lot. And mm-hmm. then we also have our projections, our predictive mm-hmm. capabilities within the world. And Andy Clark is a philosopher that kind of philosophizes about neuroscience. And I actually pulled out this little quote because I think that this is a really salient thing to bring into the conversation. He says, since brains are never simply turned on from scratch, not even first thing in the morning when I awake, predictions and expectations are always in play, proactively structuring human experience every moment of every day. On this alternative account, the perceiving brain is never passively responding to the world. Instead, mm-hmm. it is actively trying to hallucinate the world, but checking mm-hmm. that hallucination against the evidence coming in via the senses. Mm-hmm. In other words, the brain is constantly painting a picture, and the role of the sensory information is mostly to nudge the brushstrokes when they fail to match up with the incoming evidence.
That means sounds that we awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I should have coded that in my book because it's really well described. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and he kind of goes on to say that this also means that the experiences that we have had within the world are going to form the way that we conceive of these conceptions of these mm-hmm. hallucinations that mm-hmm. we are projecting outwards to maybe make up for this 1/5 of a second time yeah. travel experience that we're having.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that's so elegant about what that passage does is it says we're playing this hallucinatory prediction game, but we are playing it in a real world. Like we're playing it in an actual physical world that has actual physical contact, like consequences. And the real world's not an invention, but our perception of it is. And,
yes.
And that is bananas. Like the technical word is bananas for that. But what does that mean to be conscious? What does that mean to be human? What does that mean to like have emotions and predictive behavior? And all of that stuff is like what I'm like running through in this dream book. Like that's my entry point. And it also like interestingly answers one of the questions in my book, The Wedge, that was like missing for me. Like, you know, in The Wedge, I'm talking about the same stuff, like stimulation coming from the outside world. How you respond to that stimulation, is that a bad thing or a good thing? Like, is that ice water going to kill me or is it going to make me healthy and do I enjoy it? So that ability for you to say, okay, this is fun is like a sort of a superpower that humans have. But one of the things that I did not adequately explain in The Wedge is where emotions come from in the first place. Because like, how can you be sad or angry or fearful of something if you don't even like have the ability to form the idea of sad or fearful or angry? Where does that emerge from? And this book allowed me to sort of fill in that gap. And emotions come from dreams. Like they actually emerge from dreams. You can't have, like, you know, when you wake up and you have a bad night's sleep, you know how the next day you're sort of an asshole. Like you say mean things to your partner. You snap on somebody on the phone and it's like, you feel like it's sort of out of character. And it's because you didn't sleep. It's because you didn't get emotional processing that night before. And we can go all into what that's all about if you want to go that direction.
To some degree, I think I want to leave some of that in the book. I think it's interesting to talk about this, though, because I think it forms the foundation of who we are. And I was really interested. This is going to be a little silly. Let's see where you take this. But you mentioned the word gist 6 times in the book. And I thought that this was...
Oh, I sent you the PDF, didn't I? I'm like,
yeah,
what?
So I get to search it. and I love this. And you talk a lot about how the gist of our dreaming, and I have a quote here, is is emotion. You say, as the brain cycles through whatever got collected in your bin of short-term memories from the day, a cognitive process kicks in to discard useless information and forge them into gists of memories that later turn into the basis for your emotions. Another way to say that is that as the brain churns through the grist of short-term memories, it spits out two byproducts, emotions and long-term memories. Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by how often you return to the word gist in such a short book, because I had recently learned that there's sort of this relationship between the word gist and yeast. The word yeast is based on gist, which the Latin is to boil down. So to boil down to the essence. Whoa. But yeast is also from gist. And what I find interesting about that is that yeast is sort of the boiling down of life, but also the place from which life proliferates. And whoa, I think that deep. Emotions...
Only a butcher would come up with it, A. But go on.
I think that emotions are that thing, right? This is the very fundamental aspect of who we are. And it is also the place from, like, the proliferative, generative force of who we are.
Yeah. All right. We're going to do this real quick. I have a Patreon page and I'd love you to sign up for it. I also have a Substack newsletter, and you can click the links down below to get early access to my stuff, get an insight into the strange things that go on in my brain, and you'll support this amazing channel so we can do more interviews like this and these other interviews, like the one I did with Willoughby Britton about how meditation can kill you. Though sometimes, usually not, but occasionally. Please go check those out and consider supporting this channel. And thank you for being here. And now back to our interview. We like to think of ourselves as like Vulcans. Like, we like to think of ourselves, we are very logical in everything we do, and we're smart, and we can look at the data of the world and, like computers, figure it all out because we are super duper smart. Like, we don't actually think of ourselves as Vulcans, but we like to think that our decisions are as logical as a Vulcan's.
And we love to think that.
Right.
But very rational.
Very rational. Oh, I'm right, because look at my facts. But like, most of the time we take actions not because we've thought it out, we've crunched the data. We act because we feel we should do something. Should I cross the street or not? So I look right and I see a car, and I don't say, well, rate times time equals, okay, and that's about 50 meters. And then it will intersect with me at X point in the middle, so I will not go now. No, I'm like, I look at that, I'm like, that scares me a little bit. I will wait. That is like usually how we react, where I go down the street and I see someone who I love and I'm like, oh, it's so good to see you. Or I see someone who I hate and I'm like, I don't like you at all. And I go across the street or whatever. And like, it's all feelings. And that feelings are actually based on data, but it's based on data that was processed by dreams, because throughout the day, your short-term memory is collecting everything. Like, I like to think of the brain as, it's not an exact anagram, connect, it's not an exact metaphor.
Analogy.
But we'll go with an analogy. There we are.
Analogy.
It's not an exact analogy, but we're saying that the brain is sort of like a computer, and you have your RAM chips, those short-term things. When you turn off your computer, it all vaporizes. And you have long-term memory, the data storage, ones and zeros on the hard drive. In the day, you work on RAM, just like a computer works on RAM. It's all short-term stuff. It comes in and it just sort of floods your senses, and it's sort of there. And you actually collect more information than you can consciously access, but it's all sort of there. At night, your brain's like, I don't want to fill up my hard drive, so I'm going to discard all the crap, like, the quality of light, someone asked me to take out the trash. I don't need to remember that when I'm 80. Right? I'm just going to discard all of this information, but then compress it into essentially like a zip file. And then that stuff, that compression is an emotion. Like, all of that stuff gets compressed into one little thing, and then it's stored in like this very easy to read format. And it's like a feeling about things. And that is why we dream. Like that, well, there's like a few things that happen in dream, but that's like one of the primary functions of dreaming.
I think it's really interesting that you couched that in terms of computational efficiency. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you why. And it's what surprised me the most about your book was this exploration and flipping on its head of productivity. And productivity features a lot within the context of the book. And the idea now, I think, is that we have this idea that all the conversations that we're having around sleep are around efficiency, right? We have our little tracker devices, and we just want to make sleep as efficient as possible, instead of maybe leaning into a different version of sleep that you begin to define in the book. And even the language that we have around sleep is the language of economics and of efficiency. And maybe in many ways, the reasons that humans have been so efficient at sort of world girdling, as it were, for better or for worse, right, is that we sleep less than our primate ancestors, making us arguably a more efficient organism.
Yeah. I mean, you what was the quote by, I think it's Alan Rechtschaffen? The sleep scientist, one of the early most important ones, said that if sleep was not absolutely vital, then evolution made a horrible mistake. Like, it's the biggest mistake evolution made, because you're spending 8 hours not doing stuff when life needs to do stuff. Like, you need to go mate, you need to go hunt food, you need to do the things. So why are we spending 8 hours not doing things? It had to be very, very important to our survival. But you know, that question of efficiency is really interesting, because I think that sleep has also been hijacked by industrial, you know, the industrial work method and the invention of electric lighting, you know, the 9-to-5 work day. It all messes up with our sleep. It's not, we didn't evolve to be in a, you know, to clock in and clock out of a factory. Like, that's something we hijacked.
No. And, you know, it's funny, one of the things that's been happening to me lately is I'm usually reading like 4 or 5 books at once, whether that's smart or not. And it's interesting the way that they'll overlap, not on purpose, right? I don't know that they're going to overlap, but I've been reading them. I've been reading Saving Time by Jenny Odell. Have you seen this book?
No. Cool.
I've been reading a lot about time this year. So I read Richard Muller's Now, which is The Physics of Time. I read Alan Lightman's Einstein's Dreams, which is sort of a fictional account of time. But Saving Time has been a really interesting peek at the rise of productivity and the rise of efficiency, and even the way that we began to codify time. And I thought that you touching on this was really critical, that we have this space where electric lighting comes into the picture, and all of the sudden that creates this means by which we can create more work hours in the day. And so that people that are selling their time as labor can then labor longer, better, more efficiently,
make more money. Like,
make more money for corporations, get on more assembly lines. And you also touch on bell hooks and Trisha Hersey looking at the nap ministry and how plantations thought about labor time and what that did to Black sleep.
Absolutely. I mean, Trisha Hersey's book is it the Nap Manifesto? And I forget the exact title of it, right? But anyway, she founded the Nap Ministry, which is like, get around a nap and do it as an act of revolution against the grind culture. That's how she calls it. And I think that's a really good way to call it, is that we grind as Western Americans at labor that doesn't always serve our purposes. It serves someone. That's why you're selling time. Like, I don't need to, if I was selling life insurance, selling other people life insurance doesn't really let me survive in any real way other than I get money to do the things I need to do. But then you expand those work hours to take up as much as possible. And as a segue, I just want to say that COVID sucked. But the one thing that it did for us that was so remarkable is that so many people started working from home. And then they realized when they worked from home, they could get their stuff done in a reasonable amount of time. And then they could fuck right off and do whatever the else they wanted. They could take naps. They could take a walk around the block. And it wasn't like this guilty, like, I have to, like, the time is what matters, not the efficiency. And I think a lot of people, not all people, of course, but a lot of people have been sort of breaking that bond. And I think the reason most people don't want to go back to the office right now is because they're like, forget that. I hate selling my time. It is inhuman.
It is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is in many ways inhuman, and we haven't been doing it really for all that long. And we used to have a lot more time. I actually think agriculture breaks time in a really specific way, that prior to this, as hunter-gatherers, we had a lot more leisure time, a lot more time to lean into naps and to perhaps into polyphasic sleep. And these other modalities of sleep that, as you talk about in the book, we might not even have ever experienced as modern humans.
Or we look at something which is totally natural as something which is bad. For instance, waking up in the middle of the night, at midnight, like oftentimes I'll wake up somewhere between midnight and 3 a.m. for a little bit. And I'll look at the ceiling and I'll be like, gosh, why aren't I asleep? I need to be so productive tomorrow. And we all hate that. We're like, oh man, I had terrible sleep last night. Whereas in our evolutionary past, if you just put a human in a natural light cycle for, I think, 3 weeks, they become polyphasic, which means they wake up in the middle of the night and they have this sort of semi-conscious state where they're up there and they're thinking thoughts that are different than waking thoughts. You know, they're like sort of more abstract, especially if you test them. They have these more abstract connections and they're thinking things that's more emotional, more spiritual. And that is normal human consciousness. Like that is bang standard normal. It's not really insomnia unless you think that you have to. The unnatural thing was I'm waking up at 8 and I'm going to be at the office at 9. I'm going to leave at 5 or 5:30 or 6 with overtime, right? That is the unnatural thing. It's not the waking up, which is why, and the other thing that humans do is around 3 p.m., something which corresponds with a melatonin dip, around that time, about 8 to 10 hours after you wake up in the morning, your melatonin drops. The other thing that happens there is like, that's normal. It's normal to take a nap as a primate at 3-ish p.m. Work doesn't like that.
not to drink another coffee, another Red Bull, another Monster Energy drink, and to power through it and to sort of go into this, you called it a relentless culture, which I really liked. And that is my sleep pattern. I wake up in the middle of the night.
Wouldn't it be amazing if you just woke up in the middle of the night instead of had the first thought, gosh darn it, I'm not asleep. Gosh, God damn you, God's asleep, right? Right?
How do you know what I'm thinking?
Right? What if instead, because we all think it, right? We're raised in this culture. What if instead we thought, oh, well, where are my thoughts going? Let's see what this is about, right? And then, because sometimes I'll, in that crunching night of anxiety, sometimes you just like your brain spins in like meaningless ways, but sometimes it spins in ways that are actually super useful and gives you like actionable things to do in the morning. And you feel anxious about it. Maybe your anxiety fueled it. Like there's a lot of things to pick apart here, but sometimes I'll wake up in that middle of the night and I'll have the big idea. And then that big idea becomes useful when I'm writing in the morning, or, you know, if I was going to go hunt anacondas, and I found the perfect way to hunt an anaconda. This is my hunter-gatherer past.
Anacondas.
Anacondas. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Delicious.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Don't let them eat you. Yep. You eat the anaconda. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Go to Florida. I think you can hunt pythons in Florida just willy-nilly because they're taking over the Everglades.
See, and there we have it. And see, what a nice random thought we had, which means we're good dreamers.
I really liked this exploration, and it actually helped me reframe my own middle of the night wake ups, where I often become ruminative in a negative way. I get on the worry wheel, and spin and run. But lately, I've been exploring what it would mean to enjoy that time, and I tend to live I'm lucky enough to live in a pretty circadian aligned situation and to be able to do that. I did want to bring up, I had to pull this out because I think it's really interesting that you explore second sleep and you explore this as a time that has historically correlated with a lot of spiritual practice, that a lot of monks and priests and various times that this was a time to become more connected with God. And because I just can't help myself. In this book, Saving Time, she talks about the creation of the clock, which is actually born out of the bells from these monasteries, and that they set these regular chunks of hours that were initially calls to prayer, including that eighth one in the middle of the night, and that the bourgeois class adopted these as a really great way to demarcate a cleaner idea of labor. Yeah. And that this is where a lot of actual clock hours were born out of. And so I thought that there was a funny little connection in there.
Time and spirituality are like central to the human existence. What, you know, the Mayan cycles, we have these seasonal cycles, the day cycles, why do all the ancient religions care about the equinox and the solstice and all of these other things? So then the demarcations during the day became vital to prayer, right? We have in Islam, right, it's you pray five times a day, right, at different demarcated times, and that segmented your day, and it was essentially a spiritual thing, right? You know, I would assume, and who knows how religions really start? Like, there's so many questions, right? But I assume lots, like, this is, it's because we're giving praise to God, we're supplicating, or we're taking a time to think about our relationship for why we're here. But then that becomes super convenient also to be like, well, you got your call to prayer, yes, but then get back to work, right? So you sort of invert it to become a tool of the society that controls us. And if anything about dreams, like if you think about what a dream is, it's so random. You're connecting all this random information and you're thinking very abstractly. Like, it is revolutionary. Like, dreams were like designed to be revolutionary because they're like, we're not doing the A to B focused thought stuff. This is our time to be like insane. Like you hallucinate, you're being super abstract, and that abstraction is vital to the human organism. Like, it's there because of evolution. And as we progress as a society where we dream less because we dedicate less time to sleep, we are becoming less human because we're not sleeping well, in part. There's a lot of other reasons too, but like, that's a big one.
I wondered in this, because we do bend time in dreams, and this becomes and this space, the second sleep that you describe, becomes a space for creativity. And because you set so much of the book kind of talking about some productivity and efficiency that led to some of our sleep deprivation, I started to wonder if creativity was, and dreaming and creativity were the antidote to some of our efficiency and productivity, that they feel to be antithetical to that.
Well, why do we have to be so, why do we have to be so productive? Like, that's a great, just essential question that I think we have to grapple with as a society. Is like, what is the point of being productive if it doesn't serve you? Like, if it doesn't, like, you know, obviously we need to eat, we need to meet our needs. Like, there's a level of productivity which does have to happen, as it has happened since the beginning of evolution. You found your mates, you hunted anacondas, right? You did those things, but it wasn't all about productivity. Like, I have cats, okay? I have two cats, and I think there's one right here. Yeah, there's one sleeping right now, and it is doing just fine with its nap. And I'm assuming that the cats in the wild sleep a hell of a lot too. That was super evolutionarily useful for them to get there. And as humans, when we think that productivity and the reason of being alive is doing things. So what do I do? I write books, I make silly YouTube videos, I podcast, and you butcher things and and that stuff is meaningful to who we become, because what we are is what we do. But it's also like how we ponder, how we ruminate, how we make sense of this. Like, why is making silly YouTube videos important? Like, it's not the YouTube video creation, it's what those mean. It's like, you're listening to this podcast because it is meaningful to you. It's not just a distraction, I hope. I mean, actually, I don't know, listener. Maybe it's like...
Yeah, we won't make assumptions about you, listener.
Right.
Might be distracting yourself. That's okay.
Right. Yeah. And then again, maybe distracting is good. You know, and you also mentioned that time in dreams. And I think we can look at that for just one second.
Please.
Whereas in the day, time goes forward. Like it's, you know, 1 minute after another, or actually, you know, the way we experience time is not actually segmented like a clock. Like sometimes time feels like it moves faster and slower during the day. Like that is a physiological empirical reality. But in dreams don't give a fuck about time.
Nope.
Like, it's like, here I am in my childhood bedroom and now I'm being chased by dinosaurs, which I never have met, right? But and now I'm in the future and now I'm fighting terrorists. Like it's it all happens in one seamless simulated hallucination that makes perfect sense to you. And you don't feel any different in that dream space. Like you feel like you're yourself in that entire thing, even though time is bending all around you, like the movie Inception.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And I think that this was, sleep allows us to time travel. I mean, mm-hmm. both literally, if you're out there with some dinosaurs, but also within the space of, and you say this, when we're awake, time seems to move forward in one direction. And the transitions between who we are from one moment to the next retain a measure of continuity. In dreams, it's entirely possible or even ordinary to perceive yourself in a different body with a smaller or taller frame, a different gender, or the ability to mm-hmm. fly, while at the same time moving between different time frames. And mm-hmm. and so it is, it's bending and changing our concept of time. And I think it is also laying down that emotional foundation that mm-hmm. also changes our perception of time throughout the day, because mm-hmm. fear makes time slow down. Mm-hmm. And sometimes joy makes time slow down. Sometimes it makes it speed up, you know? And mm-hmm. so that also changes our time reference in our waking lives.
Yeah. And like, if you have like, you know, what anxiety makes things slow down. Like if you have a traumatic event, that actual time period stays with you like a keyframe in a video editing for years and years and years until you are able to process it, discard it, reduce it to a gist, or discard it. Like it, like we like to think that everything makes total, perfect, rational sense, but our reactions to the world, the way we actually experience being alive, it is bizarre if you actually start like segmenting, like what was happening here? Like, why is my mind flitting back to my dreams last night? Or why am I thinking about the last time I spoke with you on this podcast? Like that actually happened, what, a year or two ago. And yet we're the brain casting a thought to a different time is time traveling. It's
yes.
just not my body is time traveling, but my simulation, you know, I don't experience the world. I experience my simulation. So I can move my simulation around consciously. That's bizarre. It's bizarre. It's awesome.
One of the things that's actually come up a lot this year on the podcast, I was just reading Kat Bohannon's Eve. Have you picked this up? I feel like you'd actually really like it.
You better put a book list for me to look at, because it's not, you've given tons of great great suggestions.
I'll give you a book list, and there's always a book list in show notes, because that's what I like about this, just mm-hmm. a book recommendation podcast. She kind of talks about how crucial the idea of story might be to the evolution of what it means to be human. And I think mm-hmm. fundamentally, story is our ability to look at different situations, you know, and Daniel Quinn also would argue that within hunting, this really happens, that we're telling a story.
As Daniel Quinn, the guy who did Ishmael? Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Right. Okay.
I'm yeah.
What?
Yeah, I know. This is going to be weird, but I'm going to go there. Whatever. In the story of B, he talks about this idea that our ability to tell ourselves a story is part of what makes us human, and that mm-hmm. the first stories may very well have been about hunting, because what we're doing is we're looking at a set of tracks. Mm-hmm. And I hike every morning, and with some light snow cover, I've been looking at a lot of tracks.
Totally.
And to think about what might have happened in the past, right? So I'm looking mm-hmm. at these little mouse tracks and watching it scurry and imagining what might have happened and telling myself this story that will then lead into my present, where I have intersected with these tracks, and mm-hmm. a predictive measure of where that mouse might be in the future. And mm-hmm. so I think our ability to dream and to time travel and to have memory and emotions mm-hmm. is this actually bending of time in mm-hmm. a way that we don't always think of as that.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned this. I will talk about my own wildlife tracking experiences, which just happened this morning as well. Last night, my cat brought a mouse into the house. And
excellent. I love it when they do that.
And we noticed it like looking under the refrigerator, like really intensely. And, you know, I went down there with a flashlight. I couldn't see the mouse. I was like, ah, she's probably inventing it. Like she didn't, she's acting like there's a mouse, but there's no mouse there. And then, and, you know, my wife and I were both looking there and whatever it did. We went to bed this morning. We found a dead mouse on our carpet. Right. So we're like, oh, yep, she was into it. And then this morning I was out taking out the trash or something, and I saw the mouse tracks and I saw my cat's tracks in the snow. So the whole story has come together through signs of never seeing the live mouse, but knowing exactly what happened. But we do piece that information together, like seeing tracks in snow indicates historical past, but it's meaningless unless you know what that means. Like if you see the owl's wing feathers in the snow and you see the blood on the snow, like you still, you're creating that story. And I forget in Story of Bee, it's been like 25 years since I've read that book, but there were anthropologists who used, I can't remember the name, but it's like homo narrativist. That's not the word, but like, it's the idea, like the storytelling human is.
Yeah. That we are a storytelling human. And Eve Cat Bohannon makes an argument that language might have really first occurred around the concept of a story. And and she tells this story of perhaps the first woman to tell a story. And I think that we are very much story creative. And you talk about this too, that perhaps when we go to sleep, we could tell ourselves a bit of a bedtime story.
Oh yeah. If you want to fall asleep, here's a trick. Here's like, I have a couple hacks in the book, like a couple things you can do because everyone wants some tips. And I found this one really cool. It's just close your eyes. The first thing that comes into your mind, whatever that might be, maybe it's you're in a place, like you're in a forest, right? And you think about the forest and you say, well, what happens next? And then you see a rabbit and then you follow the rabbit. And then the rabbit gets eaten by an anaconda, right? And then the anaconda slithers away, and then you chase the anaconda, and then you pet the anaconda. Like, it doesn't really matter what happens, but you just add one event after another, and that can actually lead you into that free associative sleep that like, lets you fall asleep, or at least you just get a good yarn out of it. Because you're letting your brain do the thing the brain wants to, and you can just lead it into that.
I loved that because I'm constantly telling myself stories, and it was a way to have a little bit more agency and autonomy over the, I think sometimes I feel like I'm going along in the story that my brain is telling me. And instead this felt like you get to sort of begin to weave that yarn instead of just following your brain down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. And it's natural. And I don't know if it matters. Like, I don't really know if the content of dreams directly matters. And this was one of the things that I was talking about with a neuroscientist at MIT named Adam Har-Horwitz. And I was like, look, if you're the dream guy, and he's like the dream guy right now, I was like, if you're dreaming, like why, and their dreams are important, why can't you remember them? And he was like, why do you think we're supposed to remember them? And I was like, you're just supposed to experience them. Like they're doing their like forgetting thing, and you're supposed to experience those things. And that's like the free association that's going on in your brain as your brain makes new neural pathways. Like in the day you make focused neural pathways, I see anaconda, I must kill, I hit anaconda on head with, I don't know, how do you hunt anaconda? You probably know better than me. With a,
I don't know.
A thing. I hit it with a thing.
Yeah. We'll club it.
Yeah. We're, you club the anaconda.
Yeah. That sounds great.
So, but it's a focused thought. Whereas the dream thought's like, there's the anaconda. Wait, no, is it a rabbit? Oh, wait, who are those terrorists? I like elephants. Like, and it goes through these like random directions to tell the story. And all of those are emotional associations. They become emotional associations as well. And dreams don't need a direct path because they don't have a direct output. Whereas in the day, you do have direct outputs. Dreams allow you to think outside the box. And most of the time, it's probably useless, like to be efficient. But you know, what's the point of being efficient in the first place?
Yeah, that was exactly what I was thinking as you were saying that, that you can just allow dreams to be what they are. They don't have to be this thing that mm-hmm. creates an output. They can just be this experience that perhaps mm-hmm. creates an emotion mm-hmm. that provides a foundation. And yeah. maybe even, and I kind of want to go back in time because you said something about anxiety and these sort mm-hmm. of, you know, if you have PTSD and a memory that the dream space is also a space of healing. Right. And you mm-hmm. got into this idea of suggestibility, which mm-hmm. I really loved. And you talked about, I thought this was so great. In America, at least, we like our rugged individuals who buck any attempt at undue influence. Isn't it strange that every attitude towards stubbornness also correlates with worse healing outcomes? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And within this context, you talked about some of the placebo and nocebo effects and how dreams can be a space where our minds begin to heal and our bodies mm-hmm. heal too.
Yeah. And with the placebo effect, what they find is that the people who get the best placebo responses, which is like your, you know, placebo effect gets this bad rap is like, oh, that's just placebo. But like in my mind, like if you healed, so the output was important, right? And so if you can have a better placebo effect, that seems good to me, whether or not it's quote unquote medicine or not. Like I don't care about medicine. I care about the outcomes and outputs. And the people who have the stronger placebo responses are people who are suggestible, who are manipulatable, who are all of these things that we think of as weak, as like really bad traits. Like, I don't want to be a person who's just a sap. I'm the best skeptic in the world. Well, being the best skeptic in the world actually makes you unhealthy. And so how do we reckon with that? Like, how do you be, because I don't want to be taken advantage by charlatans, right?
But absolutely. I don't want to answer every email that says that they have my Netflix account password.
Right. You don't want to be a sap. On the other hand, like you can just, for some things, if you just let go and you're like, okay, we're going to see where this goes, that actually can make you, you know, it can do the, whatever your body needs to do to heal because you're not forcing an issue. And and so if you can teach yourself to be suggestible in the right contexts, right? And that's the trick, right? And that's where I don't have the answer. What is the right context? And Scott will not tell you because he doesn't know either. Because I've been taken advantage of by like charlatans as well, you know, over the years.
Me
so,
too.
So it does happen, but don't be too hard and don't be too soft. You know, and that's it's the yin and yang of dreaming too. Like you have your unfocused time for 8 hours a day, you have your focused time for the rest of the time. And that's okay. And the other thing, you know, and I end the book with this really cool meditation called Yoga Nidra, which is sort of getting like popular in the press these days.
I think Huberman has the non-sleep deep rest Yoga Nidra protocols have popularized that.
Yeah. And, you know, actually I talked to Andrew when I was doing this book and I was like, hey, hook me up with your Yoga Nidra sources. Cause like, I didn't have good ones. And so he hooked me up with Kamini Desai, who has a book called Yoga Nidra, which sounds like on topic, on brand. So I talked with her and when I was reading the book, it's interesting. Like, her book is like mostly like, here's why you need to Yoga Nidra. Like, it's like all like the why, the you need to do this because it makes you better in a number of ways. And it's like 300 pages of that. And then it's like, here's how to do it. Like at the end, which is essentially listen to a playlist and then follow their instructions. Like it's not so different than hypnosis. And there are ways to do it yourself without the playlist, like this, because it's an ancient technique that happened even before records were invented. But it's a way of thinking about your body and sort of letting go and having calmness enter to your body and like allow yourself to heal or implant a suggestion that in your subconscious that then what may play out in the future. And the crazy thing for me is like I had set up this interview with her like 2 or 3 weeks beforehand. And I was on a Zoom call and I like the day before or 2 days before I got COVID, like I was like, you know, crummy COVID, not, you know, wonderful feelings. And I was like, but oh, okay, I'll do the interview anyway. And we did this and she's like, oh, you should do my Yoga Nidra and sleep like with my yoga going and I'll do one specially for healing your body. And I was like, cool, we'll do that. And it actually was the turning point in my COVID. Like, I wasn't going to die anyway, so I think I was going to survive no matter what. So let's not like say this is like mana from heaven. But for me, after my 30-minute yoga nidra nap, I felt a ton better, and it coincided with that turning point in the illness, you know, going away. So there's my total anecdotal evidence for why this is cool.
And I think it's cool for a lot of different reasons too. The first time I did yoga nidra, I didn't know what I was getting into. It was probably 7 years ago. I fell into it and had never had that experience really of having that body awareness and deep rest at the same time, of not being asleep, but being asleep. It felt like almost a positive, an inverse to sleep paralysis in a lot of ways to me.
Yeah, so anyone who's never done it before, just try it. I have my yoga nidra in the book. There's I wrote the script out, but like you can't read that as you're sleeping. So I also have like a YouTube video. I think it's at like scottcarney.com/dreaming. I'm gonna guess.
We'll get a link in there.
Yeah, yeah. Go to there, and like it's a free YouTube video, and I took out the ads, so you can go just sleep. And I think I put an hour or half an hour of silence at the end too, so it doesn't go right into the next video in your queue or whatever. But the idea is that as it guides you through these sleep stages, like, you know, you're in hypnagogia, you know, you're sort of going, you feel like you're asleep. It feels familiar, right? Yoga nidra feels familiar because you're in these like very deep wave sleep settings, and yet you are also aware. So it's unfamiliar and familiar at the same time. And it's cool. Like it's
cool.
Yeah. It's hard to describe a sensational state. It's hard to describe experience, but like, you know, it ain't gonna hurt you. You know, I should have put a line in there like, "Give me your credit card number." We'll see if that works, right? But I didn't. And as you go there, you're aware of things, and then you also it instructs you to let go into doing nothing. And how do you describe doing nothing? And that was like, I wrestled with that for like a month. Like, how do I say to do something when I'm telling you not to do something? What is non-doing? In a sense, you just don't do it. Oh, it's like Nike, just don't do it. A reverse swoosh. And then things happen, because even the act of choosing not to do something is an act of doing something.
Oh, that's a tongue twister. That's a mind bender. Yeah. That's really interesting too, because I think that a lot of this book is creating an invitation or permission to do a little bit less and to allow your mind to drift a little bit more. And, you know, I think we've talked about in the course of this interview, a lot of dreaming at night. But this was also a permission slip to daydream and to let your mind wander during the day. And as I was reading it, one of my favorite things to observe, we live on a farm, are my goats when they chew their cud. And I find that animals, especially probably even your cats, drift in and out of a certain presence that sometimes they feel very embodied, and other times they feel adrift in a sea of nothingness. And when goats chew their cud and are ruminating, right, so to speak, they sort of drift away into nothingness. They'll just kind of sit in the sun, and there's something about them that goes away. And that has taught me a lot about allowing my own mind to drift away. And I think that this was also about reclaiming a space of daydreaming.
I love that. And like, doesn't chewing your cud just sound amazing? Like,
it sounds so good.
So I have a question for you. This is completely unrelated to my book. Okay. But as a butcher, you may, and a farm dweller, you may actually be able to answer this for me. Cows have four stomachs, right? Four or three?
Four chambers. I mean, it's not quite a literal, like, it's not like four separate stomachs. Mm-hmm. It's a four compartment stomach.
Okay. So they got their compartments, and they're cud chewers. Okay. Yes. I was really thinking about this like 2 weeks ago. I was like, how does that work? Like, okay, so I eat food. Do I choose the stomach I put it in? And then when I regurgitate it to chew it, how do I choose the next chamber? How does that work?
So this is really interesting. And I've thought a lot about how that regurgitation of that bolus of biomass kind of happens. And so what happens is all of it is moving through these four chambers. And as it moves through the four chambers, my favorite thing to do when I do slaughter demos is to open up the rumen and to really look at it. The texture of the stomach changes. So it goes from something that's studded to something that looks like a shag carpet to something that has a bunch of honeycomb. And the food gets successively more liquid. And then it reaches the small intestine. So it's like a strainer,
basically.
It is kind of like a strainer. Yeah. So that last chamber is very liquid. And so that first chamber, you're getting two things that are happening. They're bringing up that bolus of cud to re-chew, to break down the biomass mechanically, while you also have this whole bacterial and enzymatic milieu in that chamber that is working to break it down chemically. And it's also turning that matter within that stomach. You know, there are these contractions and like peristaltic actions.
Does it come back down through the same hole? Like, is it like, are the chambers like attached, big chamber, next chamber, shag carpet chamber, and then like small intestine? Or does it come back and then choose your own adventure?
It's a linear journey. It's always going through the same order, and being being moved through muscle movements.
So it's like when it didn't finish digesting, it was like, oh, go back up there and for more chew processing, and then it goes back down. That makes so much sense. Thank you for clearing up my confusion on what cud chewing is all about.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating to watch them do it and to pull it, like you can pull it out of their mouths, and kind of look at how it's being broken down and kind of what's in there. Or, you know, when you butcher stuff, you'll find it in their teeth. And
are they like totally, cause they're sort of like zenned out. You can just go in there and take it out and they're like, whatever.
I spend so much time with my goats. I think I'm an honorary goat. And so they just kind of let me do stuff and I can get away with a lot more. I wouldn't do this to some random goat. I wouldn't find a goat in a pasture and reach in their mouth, especially because their back teeth are very sharp. You can cut yourself and it's kind of a gnarly cut because of what's going on in there. So I don't recommend doing this at home, but I have done it. And you can smell too. You can actually smell the methane when they burp because they'll, as it moves up, there will be some little gurgles and you can smell these little methane burps.
Delightful. Yeah. I try not to smell the methane burps from my cats, but you can too if you want.
So I've learned a lot about, we got here because I've learned a lot from cud chewing about how to drift into being this, how to be a daydreamer, how to do nothing, as it were.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, brain has gone down the cud chewing route, but we are here to talk about a book about dreaming.
Well, dreaming cud chewing. I mean, I think that this is, you know, animal dreams. Do animals dream? It's all kind of related. Do animals daydream?
Well, I like the fact that when I think about evolution, we usually think about evolution in terms of morphology changing, right? Like that in order to get to the environment, in order for the animal to survive to the fittest, something physically changed. And you can look at that in their skeletal history and in the fossil record. And I think that totally evolution happened. Like we can parse it out pretty well. But what we're not parsing out very well, because it doesn't fossilize, are experiences. And undoubtedly, things had experiences. Like, I think we can take on an act of faith, experiences happen. And so if experiences happened, they also evolved over time, whether or not that the evolution occurred in brain structures. But there's also the phenomenological thing that occurs that's parallel to the body. Like animals learned language, like animals dreamed. Like, so how do we fossilize a dream? How do we access a fossilized dream? All I know is that my cat does dream. She's right here.
Yeah, I can hear her. Bring her on. We love a pet visit.
Okay. All right. Chew your cud, Portia. Chew your cud.
Portia needs to learn how to check cud chew. She's a carnivore, so she doesn't get the chew cud. Oh,
obligate carnivore at that. Yeah. She's like, yeah, can you, you're waking me up from my nap. Let me out of the room. I'm going to go do something. Sorry.
No, don't be, because we watch our animals dream, right? I watch my dog Goldberry dream, and you talk about this some in the book too, those twitches, and are they dreams or are they just experience and acting out of muscle twitches?
And every time you talk to a scientist, like a person who's like, well, I study this objectively, they invariably come to the conclusion that that is just a muscle twitch. And I know this because I study muscle twitches and I tracked it through the brain. You know, I checked the pathway that activated the motor cortex, and the motor cortex was involved. So therefore that was a muscle twitch. And like, okay, cool. You're of course, like the methodology guaranteed that that was going to be your result, because you know, this is the hard problem of neuroscience versus the easy problem of neuroscience. This is David Chalmers came up with this conception. The easy problem of neuroscience is the pathways which things occur. Like, where does the nerve fire into the brain, and how can we detect how a thought occurred? Here's the physical place of the thought. The hard problem of neuroscience is how that hardware becomes experience, becomes a thought. How can I point to love? How can I point to dream? How can I point to that? And that is the thing, like, even if you mapped out everything in the what they call the connectome, which is the total connectome of all the nerves, how they interact, and you mapped it out and you figured it all out, how does that add up to an experience? Like, I can't map that out and like, look, I have the map. Here was your dream. It's never going to happen, because the hard problem is taking it to that next step, to phenomenology. And the reason I'm talking about this is because we're talking about experiences through our evolutionary past. Animals dream, I experience emotions. Well, they didn't start with Homo sapiens, right? The emotions are way back. And how far back do they go? Well, we will never be able to answer that with objective measures, because it's not like a insect wrote a love letter that is now fossilized and stored on a CD-ROM that then I can access. That will never occur. So instead, we have to just assume through, I guess, looking at it. So cats have emotions. I know, because they manipulate me. So cats and us have a common ancestor at some point, right? It's probably like 65 million years ago-ish, around the dinosaur time, maybe even a little bit before that. So if either emotions co-evolved at a later point, or emotions start before that point. And my guess, my feeling is it goes like all the way back to whatever was first. Something that first thing, once it had it could make a decision about its environment. Yeah. Right. And I don't know when that happened. Right. But if an amoeba is wandering around and it's like, I want to eat this other bug instead of that bug, maybe it did that through emotions or something like it.
Fascinating.
And I don't know, like, here's, we're in super speculative area. No scientist could be like, well, Scott cracked the code.
Do you think chemicals enter this equation? If we're talking about prolactin, we're talking about oxytocin in the formation of emotions too, or are these two things separate? You know, one thing that you kind of tease at in this is, you know, the location of consciousness. If while we're dreaming, our body is in this state of paralysis, then our consciousness is not indeed embodied. Which, you know, and right now we have this sort of race to, like, could we contain consciousness, which I think is, I have my own opinions about.
I think chemicals form a language for consciousness
and emotion.
I don't think they are the totality of it. Like, if I inject you with testosterone, right? And all a big dose of testosterone, I can predictably say you're going to have some emotional changes, right? Predictably, that something's going to happen to you. I don't know exactly what it's going to be. Maybe you're going to rage, okay? Or maybe you're going to be super sexual, or maybe, I don't know, something that's associated with testosterone. It will happen to you. But I can't say that it was the testosterone. Like I can go one direction, the testosterone will cause something, but it has to interact with all the stuff that's in you already, right? So it's more like a verb in the sentence of your body. And I know that different creatures have different chemicals that go through. It's different hormones, different stuff. And And I think that some of these chemicals are, I think dopamine's pretty common throughout most creatures, and it's sort of the more chemical. And I know that bacteria will respond to dopamine in various ways, and you drop dopamine. And I don't know if there's a dopamine feeling that occurs, but maybe there is, maybe there's not. But I don't know how we scientifically test that. I don't know how I can't even tell you how you feel on testosterone versus how I feel. Like we can describe it with words. But how does a feeling actually get translated in a fidelitist way?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that our language is incredibly limited when it comes to describing some of these feelings. You know, we have a fairly small word box from which to choose from, and to assume that we are experiencing the same thing when we talk about love or empathy or rage or cats even. And I think that one of the things I like about the book in particular is that it's tugging at the idea of the constellation of experience, both coming in terms of perception and being created within in terms of conception and being predicted outwards in terms of time as interactions with other humans, with me, Kate, and you, Scott, you know, across a 3,000 mile stretch, and you, listener, and all of this is coming together to create this complex experience of our own consciousness, which we are never going to find in the fossil record.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like, it's sort of like the way you describe it, we sort of need a flow chart. Here's the stimulus. It goes through X, Y, and like, and it's so interconnected and weird. And like where I come down on consciousness and is probably alienated for people to hear at first is that I don't think we are conscious. I don't think Scott is conscious. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Kate is conscious. I think consciousness is an act that occurs, and it is about the interaction between two things. So I am not conscious as a person.
Yes.
I enact consciousness and we build consciousness by interacting, and consciousness ebbs and flows. And it's also about the interactions inside my body, but it's not a static thing. And some people, when I talk about this, they'll write to me as like, Scott, you don't believe in a soul, right? You don't believe that the body has a ghost in it that creates all activity. I'm like, well, you're right. I don't believe that. But I do believe that if this thing like a soul is out there, it's really we're all participating in it. It's something that's so much bigger than us. It is the super organism of life on Earth. And that's embodied in me right now. And it's embodied in you right now. It's embodied in your listener and my cat and all of those things. The anaconda in my dreams. It's all embodied in all of these things. And we participate in it. And we have this certain amount of time to participate in it. And when we die, and I did this video on my YouTube channel, you know, what happens when we die? And I'm hitting on some of these notes there. Your activity in life changes the environment around you. Everything's activity changes the environment around you. And those reverberations go out like ripples to infinity to some degree, like to, because one thing touches another, or at least to the whole planet. And if we go out really big, if we think about cause and effect, the chain of cause and effect, you can just keep going backwards all the way to the beginning of the formation of the universe. Like this is a Carl Sagan quote. Like if you want to bake an apple pie from scratch, first you have to invent the universe. That's his quote, not mine. And at some point, the whole universe, everything in the observable universe, everything in the unobservable universe, the country of France, the moon of Europa, all of that stuff was at one point at an infinitely small singularity point that where matter didn't exist, energy maybe didn't exist. Like, I don't know what's in a singularity, but it was all there. And then it poofed out. So everything in you was attached to everything else in the universe physically at one point. Mm-hmm. And how we think about that, I don't know. But I think it's hard to think about that and not go spiritual to some degree.
It is. And it tugs at something, you know, and I've thought a lot about this. This is going to sound a little bit funny, but we'll throw it around since we opened it up through the lens of food. Right. And I think that oftentimes we can't experience whatever consciousness or self is in a vacuum, right? Because it is always in relationship to other within this world. And I think maybe that gets at some of what you're saying, is that we exist in relationship, in connectivity. And I've thought a lot about, you know, you have this singularity and everything comes bursts forth from this little tiny point, and it makes all the matter in the universe, which we then interact with in this sort of ever exchanging way through our metabolism, which I think is original Greek is to overthrow. But it is this assimilation of nutrients that cross this boundary, because we really do think of ourselves as this meat suit, as it were, from my butcher perspective. And we take in nutrients, they cross a one cell wall thick barrier and they become us. And so those things that were once other, that were once plant, that were once animal, now become a part of Kate. But before they were plant or animal, they were rock, and that rock was stream, and all of these other things throughout time that are just kind of reorganizing in this ever going exchange of energy.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. It's a web of interactions. And we like to think that time is this point, like we are a point in time. We're right here. And really we're the confluence of time. I'm the collection of things that happened in my past and all of the interactions that led to that. And so what am I? I am everything and I am nothing, right? All both at the same time. And we like to, it's so much easier for us to think of ourselves bounded at the barrier of our skin. Like I'm an atom somehow disconnected from my environment, but like you put me into the vacuum of space and I'm toast. Like I really need this planet to support me. And then everything that goes into supporting the planet, it's all connected, which I mean, to go back to dreaming for just one second,
please. This
is why dreaming is the most fundamental unit of consciousness, because during the waking life, I'm interacting with the outside world. In dreaming, I'm interacting with what I have collected from the inside, from the outside world, and reduced to gist. So like when you're dreaming, you are experiencing your experience of consciousness, which is you. Like that is what you have stored. That is you, the dream, which is why dreaming is so vitally important to who we are. And that's why it's more real than the outside world, but not in an Elon Musk way.
Oh, wow. I love that. That was perfectly said. That was incredible. And I think what an interesting thing for this to be. I mean, it's almost kind of only the only recursive loop of self that happens, though it is made out of all of our experiences of other, but it is the only sort of
interior, completely self-contained world that is in your head that you have created. That simulation is, as far as I'm concerned, me or you. And it's during the day we add to it, right? We here's some more information. We're going to grist that away. But you are who you dream. You are, and I think I have these stickers that I put out for my Kickstarter people. Like, and the quote is, you are what you dream. And the dreams are the unit of who we are.
Oh, I love that. Dreams are the unit of who we are. And it's funny because, you know, as a butcher, I like to say that you are what you eat, which is also true.
Yeah. But what would those things be without dreaming? Like, how could the cow have cowed if it didn't dream to get to and it's pre-cows, it's evolutionary ancestors. Mm-hmm. Dreams help that cow emerge to whatever. Well, I don't know what cows dream, but like they had those cyclical cycles. We have that fossil record. All of those connections are there. And the phenomenological experience of cowing was important to that cow's life, was important to who that cow was. And maybe it makes it taste different. I don't know. Maybe a happy cow tastes better than a sad cow. I actually have no idea if that's true.
It is. I mean, we could talk about different ways in which that is actually true, but it mostly has to do with cortisol and adrenaline and the way that it changes the flavor of muscles right prior to death. That cow's experience throughout a lifetime, you get into a little bit of different territory, but I could make a couple of arguments.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, that's the Kobe beef brand. Like if you massage your cows, and I don't think
Snickers.
They do. Yeah. I don't think Kobe beef cows are massaged. I'm going to go on the record here. And I think that's not, I have gotten massages. They're $200 a shot. There's no way they're putting that into cows.
I don't think they're putting that in the cows. I also think those cows aren't living out a life that aligns with their biological urges to forage and eat in the same way. And I think changes flavor and it might indeed be happiness. And we could call it phytochemical richness. You know, that if you're just being fed Snickers bars in a small space, are you really happy? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, cow is such an interesting word because, you know, there was a wild cow at one point.
Progenitor. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there was even a photograph of the last wild cow, like truly wild ancestor. I think it was in Spain. My memories are a little hazy, but there was a word for it.
Aurochs, I think.
Aurochs. Yeah. There we are. There's your ancestor. And I think the last one died in like 1905, 1904, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. That was wild cow. The thing that we have is human cow, human yep. made. Our culture has changed that cow's dreams and everything else that goes into making that cow. And it is a different thing, just like a banana. And it also has a subjective reality. There's also the thing, and maybe that you could rewild the cow. I don't know. There probably are feral cows in the planet.
Yes, but I think the question is, have we changed that cow beyond anything for it to go back in time? And I think that's kind of the question with humans too, right? Because I think mm-hmm. that we've domesticated ourselves in many ways. And I think that, you know, and to touch back into the book, I think that we have changed the way that humans dream in the last 150 mm-hmm. years anyway, maybe the last 10,000, 12,000 since the dawn of agriculture.
Certainly in the last, since 1912, when Edison invented the electric light bulb, there's like demonstrable changes, right?
Yes.
And there was an epidemiological study that came out like 3 years before the tungsten bulb came out. And we had light bulbs before then, but they sucked. Then we got the tungsten bulb, which was like oh my God, it's so cheap. And you can put it and it burns bright and everyone can afford one all of a sudden. And in the time pre-bulb to after bulb, humans slept one less hour a day, all across the world within a few decades. Everyone had an electric light bulb, and that's thousands of hours of sleep missed per year. I guess not per year. Per year would be 365, but like over the lifetime, it's thousands and thousands of hours that are missed. That's dream time. That's experiences that are lost. And those experiences have been with us since the beginning of, you know, evolution, right? You know, since our sleep cycles are in relation to the rotation of our planet in relation to the sun. Like that is, our biology is literally linked to that. That's called chronobiology.
Within a day and a year.
Mm-hmm, right, exactly. Both cycles in turn, like that's like the Mayan calendar. Both are spinning and there's like another greater cycle on top of it. But that changed in like 1912. And now we are different. We are fundamentally different because of that. We can go back to those, that biology. Like we've proven scientifically, they took some humans and they put them in a cave, and they lit them according to the normal light cycles, and you do revert. So we haven't like physiologically changed, but the change is, you know, for all intents and purposes, like you and I are not getting rid of our electric lights. Like, can you imagine how angry you would be if I forced you never to have a light bulb again? You'd be so pissed at me forever.
I might be the wrong audience for this. But yes, in general, yes, I do think that is unequivocally, like it's absolutely the case. And I also think that, you know, so much of what things get boiled down to on this podcast is our ability as humans to take a sine wave and create a line, or to take mm-hmm. a circle and create a line. And so we create this very consistent flat environment, this consistent, mm-hmm. you know, ability to turn on the day at any given time. And I guess this is a good question to ask, because I think at 1912, we see this massive shift in our biology and in how much we sleep. Though I'm also reading Ed Conway's Material World, and he talks about how much labor hours it takes to buy a light bulb versus a candle, which is fascinating because he talks about copper as being really mm-hmm. integral to this process of electricity.
For sure.
and the way that things change. But do you think that with the, I mean, now you can't even sell incandescent bulbs. We're changing our lighting once again into LED lights with even more exposure to blue light from not just our light bulbs, but also our devices. And do you think that that will take us down again?
The tungsten bulb is fire, essentially. Essentially, it's a heating up a thing. It's fire. Whereas like LEDs, that's like lasers. And it's that aspect of chronobiology is fascinating, which is why I buy my LED bulbs to simulate the old tungsten bulbs. And
me too.
Yeah. I will say that whenever I go out into places where there's like a fluorescent bulb, I feel bad.
Me too.
Because that's not a natural color. Like that's weird stuff. And I didn't go into any of this in the book, but it, you know, I'll bet you people have.
They have, yeah. And we can link to some of that. thank you. We've gone on a kind of rollicking adventure throughout the part of this podcast. And I think what I really want is for people to open up the book and to experience some of this for themselves, because I think that you put it so, number one, succinctly. I mean, this is a deliciously short read. And I think it's
110 pages, guys. That's my selling point. 100. Look how thin it is. 110 pages. And you learn, you get all this cool knowledge. The audiobook is like 3.5 hours.
It's really fantastic. We talked about this last time, but I love the way that you narrate all of your books. That's always how I've interacted with you is listening.
Because I sent you the audiobook.
I was thrilled.
Right,
thrilled.
Yeah.
It never happened to me before, and I was thrilled. And so it's really fantastic, and it's well narrated. And I think that, you know, I don't know where you want to leave listeners, but I think one of the biggest things that I took away from this is getting back to doing nothing and to resting and to dreaming.
Well said. Well said. Thanks. Go check out the book. I also have this YouTube channel where I talk about this random philosophical stuff.
Yes.
And I had this video that got really popular. I don't know if you noticed. I had a video that hit like 2 million views.
I saw this.
Like insane.
I saw this.
And it's about split brain experiments. Like what happens when you split a human brain in two and then consciousness literally divides on either lobe of the brain and they have separate experiences. And what does that mean to everything? That was fun. But like, I've got tons of more.
You things. Also have, and I feel like this year have really built on the podcast. And I know that that is cross-linked through YouTube, but I don't do a lot of YouTube because more podcast format, but Scott Carney Investigates. And you've had some really fantastic and topical investigations. I mean, I told you I really enjoyed your exploring the Bhagavad Gita when Oppenheimer came out to look at the origins of I Am Become Death. And I enjoyed your last one talking about our techno solutions to climate change.
Right. Yeah, the podcast is really it's funny. It's hard to do all of these different formats and like do them well. I'm putting more energy into YouTube right now because I don't know why, I just am. I feel like I'm juggling so many balls at once. And we'll see which balls I drop first. I'm wondering if the podcast will continue, but right now there's like 30 or 40 episodes, I think. And some of them are good. I think
they're really good. I really enjoy them. No, I think it's all fantastic. I love that you're out there and that you have a lot of different passions. This sounds funny, but I mean, just like from the vortex to this book is a very different continuum. And I think you're chasing down a lot of creative pursuits. And I think in that perhaps, you know, I don't know how this book changed your sleep habits, but I think that you really are leaning into creativity as the antidote to efficiency, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm totally inefficient. I sleep a lot. It's great. Life is awesome.
You have cats.
I have cats.
You have cats. You're a cat person. Cat people like to sleep with their cats. Like, and yeah, cats teach us about sleep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So much to say. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
This is a blast.
We'll have links to where to find you and to the book. And I'm just excited for everyone to read it. Thank you so much for coming back on, Scott.